Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Genocide Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host today, Jeff Bachman, a senior lecturer at the American University School of International Service. Thank you all for listening. Today, I'll be talking to Noah Weisbord about his book, The Crime of Aggression, The Quest for Justice in an Age of Drones, Cyber Attacks, Insurgents, and Autocrats, published by Princeton University Press in June of 2019. Noah, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Jeff. What a pleasure to be here with you.
And thank you for joining me. And can you start us off by telling our listeners a bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure. I got into the crime of aggression while I was an intern at the International Criminal Court. I was trolling around for a dissertation topic. I hear some yelling outside the office, and it's the prosecutor of the court, Luis Moreno Ocampo, and he's just getting yelled at by a 5-foot-tall, 84-year-old man named Ben Ferenz, and the prosecutor beckons me over to see what's going on. And Ferenz turns the guns on me and he said, "Why aren't you screaming? Why aren't you yelling? This is the job for the young people to do." And what he's referring to was that the United States had just tried to prevent the inclusion of the crime of aggression into the new International Criminal Court treaty, and they had just invaded Iraq. And Ferenz, as being the last living Nuremberg prosecutor, was just livid that they had turned their back on the Nuremberg precedent, one of the great legal innovations of the United States in his view. So that's how I kind of got into this subject.
Thanks, Noah. And because we don't get to it too much in the rest of the interview, are there any other personal experiences that you have that that influenced, you know, your thinking and your interest in this? I know in the book you talk a little bit about going to Rwanda for the local courts there after the genocide. Are there other personal experiences that you had?
Yeah, I come kind of at this from a social work standpoint. I had a great professor of social work who was an expert in psychotherapy with involuntary clients, people that were kind of court mandated to be in there, you know, and especially with people that had committed crimes against children, sexual crimes against children. And she pointed out that the greatest kind of experiment in involuntary psychotherapy was taking place in Rwanda. This was the late 1990s, early 2000s, after the genocide, where everybody in the entire country was being forced to being required by law to participate in this justice therapy process called Gachacha, where the communities would sit in judgment of members of their own community for having committed crimes during the genocide. And they had the power of courts to just release these community members back into the community or to send them back to these substandard Rwandese prisons, sometimes for the rest of their lives. So I sat in on these kind of justice healing experiments, and I started to realize that there was a big kind of human dimension, psychological dimension, and wonder what law can do, whether it could accomplish justice and healing, and whether these two concepts were in fact compatible at all.
Thank you. It's very interesting. And I mean, I suppose a question I have about these experiences that you had is whether you're an optimist or, maybe a pessimist or somewhere in between. You know, I would describe myself as a skeptical optimist. I don't think I would do the work I do if I was simply pessimistic, but I'm a little skeptical about what can be accomplished without fairly drastic shifts in terms of what I believe to be the impunity some states are able to operate with. This is something I kind of been, I get stuck on. And so, you know, next year I have a book coming out, which I hope will successfully demonstrate the ways the major powers have insulated themselves against accountability for the crime of genocide. And so, yeah, back to the question, you know, what about you? Are you an optimist, a pessimist? You know, in your book, you write, quote, "The hidden strength of the crime of aggression lies not with a court in The Hague or the UN Security Council, but in the way in which its existence reframes international politics." And I think this sounds optimistic. So, yeah, I'll turn it over to you.
I think I'd rather ask you, you know, after what you just said about looking at impunity from the leaders of major powers for, you know, atrocity crimes, how is it that you can stay optimistic at all? You know, I mean, I'll weigh in, but I'm interested in how you can remain optimistic in light of that.
That's interesting. I think the optimism part of it rests in what I hope are evolutions or progressions in international law and its application. And I'm thinking about the potential role the International Court of Justice can play, like the Gambia versus Myanmar case gives me some hope. Although, you know, I think as, a, you know, in terms of the major powers, it's not simply accountability for crimes they might commit against their own people, but also for how they contribute to criminal acts of other states. And, you know, I've written a bit about, you know, U.S. support for, you know, Saudi Arabia and the coalition in Yemen, and even the debates in the Congress. And so that, it gives me some mixed feelings about, you know, optimism versus pessimism. But I think more specifically, you know, as a teacher, as an instructor at a university, engaging with young people also gives me optimism, because of the things that I hear and the discussions we have in the classroom. But then, of course, there are the, you know, some of the skepticism creeps in when I think about, you know, how, you know, even considering, say, Noam Chomsky's Manufacturing Consent and sort of the culture of institutions. And even when people who mean well and get into, say, government positions, but then the sort of institutions alter in some ways, potentially alter in some ways, how their approach was when they first got into when they are actually sort of in within the institution. So I guess I could, the short answer to the question might be that I'm sort of torn between these different feelings.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the answer that someone gives to this question depends a lot on their theory of history. You know, is history a mountain to climb? Is it a, you know, two steps forward, one step back? Is it a cycle where these themes keep repeating? Is it a pendulum, you know, that's swinging between right and left, or optimism and pessimism? Or is it just nothing? Is it just where this is just some overlaid story that we're putting on top of a bunch of events that have no meaning in themselves? I guess my answer to your question about optimism and pessimism is that this book is a, one of the major themes running through it is an attack on cynicism. It's not exactly answering your question, but what I've found is that the cynics are deriding all of these legal attempts that you're mentioning, and, you know, creation of new institutions, creation of new standards and rules, agreed upon realities. They're deriding them and calling the people like Ferenc that are trying to create a better civilization, dreamers. And they say that, you know, their big thing is to not be fooled and not to look foolish, the cynics. But they are submitting ultimately. Their pretense that it's all corrupt actually excoriates, it's pretending to excoriate what it ultimately excuses. So it's pretending to be an attack on power, this mode of cynicism, but it's ultimately excusing power because nothing is of any use to do it all. That's what this book is. It's an attack on that. It's an attack on that posture.
And when you, I don't know if you want to name names, but when you're thinking of the cynics, I mean, what came to my mind was someone like Eric Posner and the Twilight of Human Rights Law. Is that sort of the school of thought you're thinking about when you refer to the cynics?
I would say it's the realists a lot of the time. So saying that there's no point in making any shared institutions or agreements that, you know, it's like Thucydides. You know, the strong do what they will and the weak accept what they must. And the cynics say, you know, that's what you have to understand. But what that's doing is that's excusing the strong for what they are doing. It may be descriptively accurate in their view, but I don't think it matches with history. It's a massive overgeneralization, a very, very dark, pessimistic generalization that is disconnected from reality, I think. And what it does is it just, what is it? Are they protecting their feelings, their expectations? Are they trying to look savvy? What does this do except reinforce the status quo?
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I wanted to spend a little bit more time on Benjamin Ferenz. And, you know, you mentioned how you had a chance to meet him. Can you tell our listeners maybe a bit more about Ferenz, you know, who also makes many appearances throughout your book, and how he influenced you and your work? And I'll make a quick note for listeners, if they haven't seen Watchers of the Sky, there's a bunch of interviews with Ferenz throughout that really show the kind of person he was, or he is, because he's now, I think, 101, I think, is how old he is. Yeah, I'll turn it back over to you.
I mean, Ferenz was, back to this discussion of optimism and pessimism, Ferenz as kind of a driving motor of optimism in international law. And a lot of, you know, I kind of set him against Henry Kissinger, who's a kind of a cynical realist view. And these two men were both Jewish men born in the ruins of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and they escaped Europe, you know, anti-Semitic persecution, and they came to completely different lessons, where Ferenz, and they both grew up in New York City, and, you know, Ferenz from a poor family and Kissinger from kind of a cultured, in certain ways, privileged family, not rich. But, you know, Kissinger came to the conclusion that you need to counter force with force. That was the main language. That was the main dynamic. And Ferenz believed in logic and reason and law. And he fought diplomatically, you know, after first being a soldier. So he was at Harvard Law School. He was working for a law professor studying accountability for international crimes. And then he left in order to fight in World War II, where he wanted to fight on the front lines, but he was too small and he had some other physical issues that prevented him. So they had him doing intelligence, and, you know, he was liberating concentration camps. He saw these atrocities. And to this day, if you speak with him about the camps, he will cry. He's still deeply affected, I think traumatized by his experiences. When he came out of that, he was assigned to prosecute the Nazis under Telford Taylor, who was the American prosecutor at the time. And he found a trove of documents. His team found a trove of documents underground that implicated the Einsatzgruppen, the mobile death squads that would round up Jews and gypsies and disabled people and kill them behind enemy lines. And Ferenz said that we need to do another case. I found direct connections, documentary evidence that these particular men had committed, I think around 20 men, over a million murders. And Telford Taylor said, we can't do it. We don't have enough staff. And then he assigned Ferenz, if he was willing to do it, to do the prosecution. And Ferenz prosecuted the biggest murder trial in history, over a million victims, when he was 27 years old, secured convictions, amazing story, and then spent the rest of his life trying to build international institutions to prevent this from happening again. So he was kind of the lodestar of this book, where he's realistic, but also kind of this engine of optimism behind it all.
Thanks, Noah. And I mean, that really, I think it, in some ways, that brings me back to 1946. You know, maybe, you know, what led to Ferenz needing to continue on the, you know, it, with his efforts. You know, in the Nuremberg judgment in 1946, it says, quote, to initiate a war of aggression is the supreme international crime differing only from other war crimes in that it contains within it itself the accumulated evil of the whole. And, you know, I've talked about Dirk Moses's book and a few times on here, including interviewing him. But he has this book called The Problems of Genocide. And he talks about what he sees as the existence of a hierarchy, and I tend to agree, of international crimes with genocide as the crime of crimes. Do you think there is such an international criminal hierarchy? And how did, if you do, how did wars of aggression or the crime of aggression seem to have been, I don't know, placed lower on the hierarchy? Or I don't really know the best way to describe it. But yeah, I'll stop there because you probably have something to say there.
I need to ask you a follow-up, though. Is why do you think that genocide is the supreme crime? Why do you think that that's more serious than crimes against humanity or any of the others?
Well, I mean, I don't want to say that I do. Just for clarification, in case you know, I think that it's treated in that manner, both in terms of when we think about Security Council action, even though it's very mixed, prevented efforts, discussion of potential preventative options, early warning signs, prosecution. It seems that, you know, the way genocide is treated within international institutions is different, I'd say, I think elevated in comparison to war crimes, especially.
I mean, I think you're right that it's treated, and people that are suffering from attacks by government forces or organized bands want their situations to be labeled genocide. So you're onto something there. They want that over crimes against humanity. They want it to be, because they feel that that's a more serious crime. But at the time of the Second World War, the primary consideration, at least of the United States, was the attack on Pearl Harbor and of Europe, of the invasions of the Nazis, of taking over all of Europe. And, you know, the stuff that happened within the states that were occupied or behind enemy lines, that was considered to be kind of, you could see it in the quote that you just read me, a byproduct of the illegal war. I don't think that the crime of aggression is a supreme international crime, but it was treated that way in the way that the prosecutors at Nuremberg designed their indictment and the way that they prosecuted. They used conspiracy to commit aggression, or crime against peace, it was called at the time, to link in all of these Nazi leaders and to show how all of these atrocities were committed towards a larger war effort to create more living space for Germans and to seize territory. So Robert Jackson, the American prosecutor, the Supreme Court judge who became the chief American prosecutor of the international military trial at Nuremberg, designed the entire case around aggression. It need not be so. But back to your genocide point, you know, you're trying to make a book about the links between genocide and warfare. But don't you think that there's some sort of psychological dimension, this creating an other group in order to mobilize a population to action? Don't you think that aggression, where maybe it's one nation attacking another, or Rwanda, the Rwanda genocide, where it's the Hutu were very divided in the early 1990s, are unified and brought together again through an attack on the Tutsi? There must be some social psychological connections there that maybe you could tell me about that a little.
Sure. Yeah, because I don't want in any way want to seem like I am minimizing any of these international crimes. You know, these attacks on groups and the way that those who both organize, plan, and incite the violence are using, I think, manipulative ways to convince some members of a population that other members of the population must be killed for their own benefit, security, or, you know, whatever, you know, the they used to incite the violence. In Rwanda, one aspect was based on the history of the country that, that the Tutsi, if we don't kill them, they're going to kill us. And then, using that to manipulate people. I think a concern I have is that, if we treat some crimes differently than others when the victims of the crimes are largely civilian populations, that are we, the question I am hoping to answer in the, in the project that you mentioned, the war on genocide, is are we elevating some human suffering over other human suffering? And I know there's different, grades, there's different scales, there's different severity, but I think of the conflict in Yemen and civilian life that has been lost. Are those lives any less significant as, victims of genocide? And, I'm not saying, I don't know. It's complicated. But at the same time, it's also simple, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm.
It is, yeah. And you can hear here, I have a quote here from Hermann Göring, who's being interviewed by his prison psychologist. And he's trying to explain kind of the role of leaders in bringing their populations to war. And it applies to both genocide and to aggression. So the psychologist challenges Göring. He says, this is Gilbert, Gustav Gilbert, the psychologist for Göring. He says, well, it's maybe easy for leaders to bring their populations to war in Germany and other totalitarian places. But what about democracies where the people have a say? Here's Göring's response. Voice or no voice, the people can always be brought to the bidding of the leaders. That is easy. All you have to do is tell them that they're being attacked and denounce the pacifists for lack of patriotism, exposing the country to danger. It works the same way in any country. And this is what the Einsatzgruppen leader told Benjamin Ferenc, the main kind of defendant in the Einsatzgruppen case. He said, why were you killing the Jews, asked Ferenc. And, the Einsatzgruppen commander said, well, if we didn't kill them, they were going to kill us. And then Ferenc said, well, what about the children? And then the leader said, well, they're going to grow up, and having seen what happened to their parents, they were going to come back and get us. It was preemptive self-defense. Said, this is the same justification in Rwanda for killing the Tutsi. This is what was being shouted on Radio de Milkalin. So there's patterns of this kind of, the security argumentation. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And we've seen, I think, similar things with Israel and Palestine, about the idea that they're going to be raised to hate us. I believe there are similar things with, or the way people, members of Al-Qaeda were talked about as well, or in places like Afghanistan, Iraq, that, they're going to hate us. And so we have to bring, the war to them, or the use of force to them.
Yes. Jeff, can I tie this in for a second? Look at what's happening in these self-defense cases going on. Ahmed Arbery, Kyle Rittenhouse, all of these people are doing preemptive strikes and then claiming self-defense, that they were threatened. And then when the prosecutor argues, well, you were armed and the other person was not armed, they say, well, if I didn't do it, they were going to take my armament. They were going to... What's happening is that there's a reappraisal of the concept of self-defense, a renegotiation that's going on right now in domestic law, but also in international law, crime of aggression, and also for these genocide arguments. You can see it with the Myanmar case that you were referring to before, where these leaders are claiming constantly self-defense, and we need a legal standard. This is an example against cynicism. We need a legal standard where we can draw a line. It doesn't have to be a perfectly clear line, but just to debunk these gaslighting arguments that that something is self-defense, like the killing of Ahmed Arbery, when it's obviously an act of aggression. So there's a larger thing going on now where we need to come to some agreement about what amounts to a legitimate defensive action against yourself or your people.
Yeah. And in that latter case, I would say fortunately, the court got it right. But that does relate to a larger question that I wanted to ask you about. And that is, you know, in your chapter, Cold War, you said bellum, you quote Ferenza saying that, quote, "it was clear that it was easier to commit aggression than to define it." And I was thinking about that, you know, quote, and then, you know, what you just said, and it makes me wonder whether it's clear that it's easier to commit aggression than to hold those responsible accountable, because they don't, we don't always hold those responsible accountable.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's two things in that question. So it talks about that, you know, raises issues in two of my chapters. First one relates to the definition of aggression and the distinction between aggression and self-defense. The second one is, how do you arrest somebody? How do you actually capture a head of state? And I have an entire chapter that just describes arrest scenarios, successful arrest scenarios. People always say that international law, international criminal law, is ineffective. But when you read this chapter, you'll see that most of the Yugoslav criminals, around 160-something Yugoslav criminals that were originally indicted for crimes in the former Yugoslavia, were captured in these sometimes spectacular arrest operations and killed or tried, or they handed themselves in. And almost the same in Rwanda with the Rwanda tribunal. So not everybody is getting captured at the International Criminal Court who they want. You know, the Lord's Resistance Army people run by Joseph Kony that were committing atrocities in Ituri, northern Uganda and in Congo and places like this. Not all of them were captured, but most of them were killed and some of them were tried. So I think if you read this chapter, you'll see that there are potential using, you know, state forces. You know, Gbagbo arrest is a very good example with French forces. Subterfuge, like the arrest of Bemba in Belgium, by Belgian authorities. Sometimes bounty hunters are used, and they hand over the people to the International Criminal Court. Sometimes peacekeepers. So the possibility of arresting a single person versus targeting an entire state for regulation creates new possibilities, and privateers are starting to come up, which is an interesting but dangerous possibility, private military contractors. So that's my hope for arrests, is in these interstices in a way. With the definition, I don't want to go on and on about the about this, but the main idea is that it's first strike is the main concept. There's a list of acts that amount to acts of aggression: bombardment, blockade, attacking the armed forces of another state. And these all come from the Nuremberg precedent and some other international legal sources that are authoritative and many of them customary international law. So these were used like building blocks to build the crime of aggression. And then there's a qualifier called the manifest qualifier, which says that only the most serious uses of force are going to be prosecutable as aggression. That's where a lot of the play is in defining something as aggression or not, is that whether by its character, gravity, and scale, it amounts to a manifest violation of the UN Charter.
Thanks, Noah. And that, you know, the definition does lead me to a question I have about the role of the, U.S. actors, officials that you alluded to earlier. You know, it seems to me that the Kampala Amendment really borrowed a lot from the 1974 General Assembly resolution defining aggression. And so, you know, when the Rome Statute was negotiated, there was this definition readily available. But you mentioned how U.S. officials were seeking to work against inclusion of the crime of aggression. And in your book, you talk a little bit about compare Bush, Obama, and Trump, their administrations. Can you talk a little bit about the differences and similarities? And then if you happen to know anything about, if you've been keeping up with the Biden administration, whether there's anything new that's come since your book?
Yeah, for sure. So the Bush administration did kind of a full-on attack on the International Criminal Court and international law. This was in the early 2000s. You know, it was John Bolton who was in charge of that. He famously unsigned the Rome Treaty, the International Criminal Court treaty. I don't even know if that's possible to do, what legal effect that might have. You know, Clinton had signed it in 1998, but they hadn't been able to push it through the Senate. So it had kind of created certain legal obligations just by the executive having signed. But so there was a frontal assault. And then in the second term of the Bush administration, that had started to harm George Bush in the war on terror, because many states were not cooperating with the United States in the war on terror because of their position on the International Criminal Court. And he dialed it back, and they appointed John Bellinger III, who is a very savvy, excellent international lawyer, to kind of engage with the International Criminal Court and help behind the scenes. So the United States became, in the second term of the Bush administration, kind of actually helpful. They didn't block the Sudan referral when the Security Council was deciding whether to refer Sudan to the International Criminal Court to prosecute Omar al-Bashir and other leaders. So, and they passed intelligence on, I believe, to the International Criminal Court. Obama was a much more complicated relationship. He believed that the United States would be stronger by kind of entrenching its view of the world within international law. So he tried at every possibility to justify his uses of force under existing international law, and they would do creative interpretations to allow uses of force in that would clearly be aggression, but they tried to argue them in legal terms, even though they were sometimes weak arguments. And the best example here is the Islamic State coming through Syria, attacking Iraq, and there being no Security Council resolution allowing the United States to use force in Syria against the Islamic State. So they use a collective self-defense argument. Samantha Power submitted this to the United Nations, saying that we're acting to defend Iraq in collective self-defense against a non-state aggressor that a state is unwilling or unable to control. That's Syria, unable and unwilling to control. So they cooked up another justification for the use of force that could then be handed as a precedent to other states. So it was a more complex relationship. You need a court or courts to judge whether these legal justifications are legitimate or not. That's what's needed now.
Mm-hmm. And what about drone strikes? Where do you... How do you think about drone strikes? You know, there's some concern that the emergence of drones as a regular tool of use of force can create not necessarily the sort of full-scale wars that we've seen, especially in the 20th century, but a sort of continuous low level of conflict based on the lack of political and you know, human risk, at least on this side, using the drones. Does this complicate the crime of aggression at all?
It's so interesting. The drone and the cyber attack developments are so interesting because kind of at a larger level, I'll get to your more specific question in a sec, but at a larger level, these are technological attempts in a way to navigate the legal terrain when it comes to the law of war. These are kind of low-level strikes, drone strikes, cyber attacks that don't trigger the law of war and the right of forcible self-defense if done just below the de minimis threshold. So in a way, states were trying to devise through technology a way to wage war that would not... turn the diplomatic and kind of political forces against them in their wars. They're sanitized wars in a way. Drone strikes are supposed to be very specific, smart weapons, just hit an individual, maybe not give rise to a Security Council condemnation, maybe not give rise to diplomatic sanctions by states that were against that particular use of force. So you can see lawfare coming into play with these new technologies where, the legal terrain is just like a physical terrain that militaries are trying to navigate. Yeah. So the big issue here is when a low-level use of force, like the targeted assassination of General Soleimani, for example, Iranian general, triggers a right of forcible self-defense, and when it becomes the crime of aggression. And because of the way that the crime of aggression has been defined, where only a manifest violation of the UN Charter, that by its character, gravity, and scale, amounts to a violation of the UN Charter, only that is going to trigger the legal regime. So these low-level strikes may fall below it. We need the court to judge what amounts to aggression. That's what's necessary.
Thanks, Noah. And that, I think we'll get back to the who should be judge in a moment. I'm very interested in, there's an exercise I do with my students about operationalizing the crime of aggression. Defining the differences or recognizing when a use of force is one thing versus another and who should be the judge and so on and so forth. And so I guess my question to you is, can the crime of aggression be effectively operationalized? In your book, you identify some hurdles. And so I was wondering if you could describe the three potentially contentious zones of interpretation that ICC judges face. Some related questions, sorry, there's going to be a bunch all in one here, is it difficult to distinguish between aggression, self-defense, both traditional and preemptive, which has come up, and military intervention for real or perceived humanitarian purposes? And associated with that, there are, if you look at the example of Kosovo in 1999, a legitimate but technically illegal use of force, does this still fall under the crime of aggression for judging? And then finally, connected to intervening uses of force, can something that began as humanitarian morph into aggression? And I'm thinking, as an example, the intervention in Libya, where I would argue that the intervention exceeded the initial mandate. And then does the question of aggression come into play?
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Okay. Yeah, I think I can divide your question into two parts. So you asked me kind of where are these zones of contestation? Where's the most controversial part of the crime of aggression? What uses of force are going to be the most controversial and hard to resolve? And you're exactly right. It's going to be self-defense and humanitarian intervention. Those are going to be the two most tricky scenarios. And also, I would add now what we were just talking about, these low-level uses of force, like a cyber attack that doesn't damage property or kill any people directly, but for example, deletes medical records, causing death. So these de minimis forms. So for self-defense, the law is actually rather clear for the most part on self-defense. Everyone has tried to blur it. All these political actors have tried to blur it. But under Article 51 of the UN Charter, you need an armed attack to trigger the right of self-defense. So you can't strike in defensive force under international law unless the armed attack has occurred. So, a preemptive strike like the invasion of Iraq in 2003 would not qualify as self-defense. However, when this is where there's the zone of interpretation. When has the attack occurred? So if you think of Pearl Harbor, has the attack occurred when the missiles have landed in Pearl Harbor? Yes, for sure. That's uncontroversial. What about when the boats or the planes have crossed into American territory in Pearl Harbor? Has the attack occurred then? Well, probably so, I would say. Well, what about, when they just left Japan, the planes, ships, does that count as the armed attack? That's more controversial. And most controversial, perhaps, is when the leaders have given the order. Is that when the armed attack has occurred? When those Japanese leaders gave the order to attack Pearl Harbor? So that's the zone of interpretation for self-defense, especially. For humanitarian intervention, it's trickier because in the negotiations over the definition of aggression, this manifest qualifier that I told you about, that only manifest violations of the UN Charter amount to aggression, that was built in part to resolve the humanitarian intervention debate. It couldn't be resolved among diplomatic delegations, with some saying that Kosovo would be a legitimate use of force, and it wouldn't amount to aggression because it wasn't manifestly illegal. Why is that? Because you can make an argument that it was done in order to vindicate international norms, such as the protection of human life, human rights norms, things like this. So I actually think that if a court would be the one assessing that, a legitimate, proper court, like the International Criminal Court or a regional court, African Court of Justice and Human Rights, something like this, then they could sort out what's a legitimate humanitarian intervention and what's a pretextual land grab, for example. So that's a gray area, but I think probably most states would say humanitarian intervention, like Kosovo, is an act of aggression. I believe that probably most states, maybe not some Western states, would think that. And finally, on the de minimis front, the big question, like I say, is like these attacks you're seeing now on hospital infrastructure by hackers and cyber attackers that are attributable to states, Chinese, Russian, Iranian, North Korean, where hospital records are deleted or held hostage, and then people die as a result of that. That's a third gray area that I'd like to see, transparent, reasoned judicial interpretation based on rules of evidence and procedure. That's how I think these questions should be resolved.
Thanks, Noah. And that leads to another question about these technological developments in warfare. In the book, you include a question, can the wall keep up? And so I guess my question to you is the wall keeping up, or mm-hmm. how can it keep up?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, this is the law that has been, this is a very conservative definition of aggression and a very conservative distinction between aggression and self-defense. It's based on primarily the Nuremberg precedent, so the London Charter and the decision of the International Military Tribunal at Nuremberg and the successor decisions, the doctor's trial, the industrialist's trial, and the Tokyo trials. The 1974 definition of aggression, which gives you that list of acts that amount to aggression that you were referring to before, attacking the armed forces of another state, allowing your state to be used as a staging ground for an act or an armed attack by another state. And then the ICC treaty, which included aggression in its language in 1998, but without spelling out precisely what aggression would mean in the modern world. I think that these rules have managed to capture all sorts of uses of force over the last 100 years, and that they're good enough through judicial interpretation to capture the uses of force that are emerging as well. I don't think we need a completely new thought out crime of aggression for cyber war, for example.
Thanks, Noah. And so something else I wanted to talk a little bit about because of my own interest in state responsibility for international unlawful acts, which I don't know if I got that exactly right, but the International Law Commission uses that terminology. You talk about the importance of holding leaders responsible for the crime of aggression, as leaders are most responsible. Is state responsibility, does it have its deficiencies? Is there a place for state responsibility in justice proceedings, perhaps concurrently with individual criminal responsibility? Of course, there was some overlap between the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia and the International Court of Justice's Bosnia versus Serbia case. As I mentioned, this is a particular interest of mine. So I was wondering, where are the deficiencies are, and is there a place for both of them?
Yeah. Okay, there's a place for state responsibility, especially for kind of tortious kind of wrongs. So, one state is polluting a river, the Danube, for example, upstream from another state, and they need to resolve their dispute about whether that's allowed or whether it's out of bounds. But I believe that when it comes to prosecution of atrocities, that the focus should be on individuals. It doesn't mean not to have state responsibility, but What I'm very concerned about is what happened in Iraq after Saddam Hussein, lost and was kicked out of Kuwait, where this sanctions against the state of Iraq just harmed the poor people of Iraq who were being victimized by their leader as well. And Saddam Hussein, of course, was rich with all sorts of finances all over the place, was leading a perfectly luxurious life, but his people were really suffering. So I'm really concerned about collective responsibility when it comes to these things. I'd rather have more focused, targeted individual responsibility. And I also think that individual responsibility properly captures the social dynamic of war, where, you know, I was referring to the Hermann Göring quote earlier, where it's leaders that bring their populations to war, not the reverse. I think that that's wrong, that it's the populations that drive the leaders to express their latent aggressive. There's kind of hostile, belligerent tinder in a society, which the leader then harnesses more often than not. It's the pyromaniac that lights the flame that needs to be targeted. And it's easier to arrest individuals than to constrain entire states. So I think there's a lot of reasons to focus regulation of aggression on the leaders themselves, not the entire state.
I think that makes sense. It's something I will have to think about as I continue to think about and evolve or develop my thoughts on state responsibility.
Jeff, back to your thoughts on state responsibility, though. You were talking about the connections between genocide and war earlier. And, you know, there is a social dynamic to these things, you know, as you saw with the Capitol riot, the Rwanda genocide, or these collective actions, which should be captured somehow legally. Do you have any sense of kind of how that collective dimension would be best captured? Do you think that like the Rwanda genocide was first and foremost a collective act or an act of leaders that were riling up the population?
I do think in general that genocide is an act instigated by leaders, through, as I mentioned before. What I really do think are collective forms of manipulation, use of propaganda. One of the things I'm interested in working on first in this project on the comparison of war and genocide is a direct comparison of war and genocide propagandas to see if there are commonalities in how leaders are able to stoke violence to socialize socialize killing people. I guess, my thinking on state responsibility is primarily around the need for states to provide restitution or reparation for the crimes that were committed sort of in the name of the state, even if a state, I guess, can't commit a crime, if that makes sense. There's definitely concerns I have about, even if such decisions are made, especially then if leaders aren't held accountable, even if the ICJ, say, finds a ruling against Myanmar, there's already been an injunction to stop the violence, but to, how to enforce its decisions in terms of, my understanding, if I'm recalling correctly, is that Serbia has not fully made repair for its failure to prevent genocide at Srebrenica in Bosnia. And I'm just not sure how these kinds of decisions can be enforced. I'm getting rambling a little bit here. But these are just some of the thoughts that I'm having about, how we can hopefully in some ways prevent future crimes, but also to repair crimes that have already been committed.
You're really onto something with the focus on the propaganda, though, the comparison of the propaganda for genocide, propaganda for war. And when it comes to, look what happened with Hitler. So Hitler mobilized the Treaty of Versailles and the reparations when speaking at the beer halls to rouse up kind of belligerent anti-Semitic sentiment and mobilize a German populace, you know, the far right of the German people against the this external enemy, these people that were sucking German funds out in order to rebuild their countries after World War I. And, you know, the Germans found this completely unfair and the economy was tanking. And this was a mobilizing force for Hitler, these reparations. They were deserved. You know, these victims in France and various places that were demolished by German aggression in World War I, the individuals were destitute and they needed help. And who should pay it? But, you know, the country that caused the problem in the first place. But there's a connection there. It's a, when there's an external threat like that against an entire nation or people, it's creating a scenario where leaders can come and try to mobilize their populations against it. So there's a risk of considering an entire people accountable for an act of war or an act of genocide.
Yeah. And, you know, which comes back to, you know, your, what you mentioned about the sanctions on Iraq in the '90s again as well. So, and you know, some of the things that you're talking about, with Goering also reminds me of, if I'm recalling correctly, it's been a while since I've looked at Mein Kampf, but, you know, Hitler in his foreign policy chapter, talked about propaganda and, never allowing yourself to moralize the enemy, come up with, you know, these slogans and just repeat, never show any sign of weakness, and that will keep your population mobilized. I think there will be some similarities in the propaganda when I get to these comparisons.
There's a very good book by my friend Greg Gordon about incitement to genocide. Definitely, I think that this kind of the patterns of propagandizing and mobilization are very important to follow and to criminalize. These things should be prosecuted as well. Maybe this is going to create an early deterrent effect. I'm not thinking that the ICC is going to send in the troops and arrest, you know, Vladimir Putin or something like that. This is not how I think it's going to play out. You're talking about enforcement before. What I think is going to happen is the first aggression case will probably be a self-referral. So what I'm expecting is that a country, it could be Russia, but it doesn't look like it now, or another country, let's just imagine the scenario of Russia, where there's resistance to Putin, there's an internal division, and opponents within Russia manage to undermine his political clout and perhaps isolate him geographically at the same time. It's possible that a state with wide, jurisdictional laws will participate in arrest, or maybe they'll hand him over like Serbia handed over Milosevic. You can see now in Sudan, Sudan is handing over Omar al-Bashir for trial after many years of him being the president. I think the first aggression case will be probably a self-referral and an arrest by the successor regime. And that will get the ball rolling as it did with genocide and crimes against humanity and war crimes at the ICC at first.
That's really interesting. And I hope you're right. Cause it also makes me think of Uganda and the self-referral as well. I would like to see that happen. I want to wind down here with you. I don't want to take too much of your time. And so I want to close by reading from the end of your book, which also brings us in some ways back to the first question about optimism and so on. And you close your book by writing, quote, "Whether history is a mountain to climb, a battle between cynicism and idealism, or a series of accumulating precedents updated when the crystalline structure snaps into a new configuration, I know Ferenz is right. The forces of hatred and injustice are encroaching, and our best hope is a coordinated global legal response. What began as an idealistic dream has culminated in a surprisingly functional, promising legal innovation. The crime of aggression will not get us to the top of the mountain, vanquish cynicism, or put an end to war. It is something more modest, a sensible step in the right direction, a memorial to the victims of a violent century, a reminder of humanity's higher aspiration that only our reason can save us from ourselves. It's beautifully written for one thing. But I do ask, you know, if the crime of aggression is a step in the right direction, what is or is there a next step?
Well, maybe I'll tell you what Foren said to me. He was starting to lose hope. We were walking in Princeton at one of these negotiations over the definition of the crime of aggression before 2010. And he said this to me: "I've been pushing this rock up a hill. I know I'll not see the top of the hill. I know that. I may be crazy, but I'm not stupid. I push the rock a little bit further up the hill, knowing that there will be times when I get kicked in the head and it slips back." You can see that Ferenc here is mixing up kind of his memories of World War II and this time now. That happens too. Pick up the rock and keep pushing it. And if there are enough people who keep pushing it long enough, we'll reach the top of the mountain, he says. Now, I'm not so sure that history is a mountain to climb. But I do think that this idea has been exceedingly resilient. The idea of having individual criminal responsibility for aggressive war has lasted for hundreds of years in various forms, and it keeps coming back. And I think that as technology becomes more individualized, where you can attack an individual with a drone or with a cyber attack that wipes out their online life, their bank accounts, their existence, really, it's going to become more and more individualized warfare, and regulation should also become more individualized. And that's where I think the hope of this new legal idea comes from for me, is this idea that it matches with the sociological dynamics of warfare that are emerging. And I hope that countries and organizations of countries and the media and religious groups learn about the crime of aggression and try to enforce this idea that some uses of force just cannot be justified as self-defense or humanitarian intervention, that some stuff is aggression and it should be condemned.
Thank you, Noah. And thank you so much for your time. Before I do let you go, I know that you're going to be sort of off the radar for a bit, but is there anything you're currently working on that our listeners should watch out for?
Well, I'm working on having these two new babies delivered next week. It's very exciting. My partner, Alana Klein, and I are expecting two kids. But yeah, I've been working on self-defense in domestic law in the United States and Canada, and trying to understand cases like the Kyle Rittenhouse case, and in Canada, the Peter Kill case, where a military reservist stalked and killed an unarmed Indigenous man in his driveway, we thought was stealing his truck. He was acquitted at trial. So it's these cases that I think overlap very closely. That's my new thing.
Great. Well, and is that an article based, or is this another book you were writing?
It's a series of articles on the evolution, historical evolution of Canada's self-defense laws compared to the American laws. The stand your ground laws in the United States. I was teaching in Florida before I came back to Canada. So I think the Canadian laws have become in some ways even more expansive, even more permissive of do-it-yourself self-defense than the Florida stand your ground law. So I've been kind of putting up the alarm, sounding the alarm on that issue.
Great. Well, thank you for your work, Noah. And I look forward to reading these when they come out. Good luck next week. Congratulations. And thanks again for joining me.
What a pleasure talking with you. Thanks for having me on the show.